Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and apparently it's available on Spotify. And joining me in studio, one of the founders of the Film Yap, one of the members of the IFJA, and a husband who gets to have dinner with adults every now and then, Chris Lloyd. Hi, Chris.
Very good to be here. Very good to be here. Congratulations on hitting the 20th anniversary.
That's work. And marriage, actually. So it's kind of one in the same sometimes.
Sort of. Are you getting a bit of a, you know, swelled head about it? You know, bursting with pride, that sort of thing?
Compared to the swelled head I had before the 20 years? Yeah, you get the punchline to them. We're recording this on the right before we get into the IFJA Bloodfest, which is a meeting that will happen on Saturday. It's Indy's version of Con 68. You know, opinions and ideas and ballots will be thrown, and it might just get downright ugly.
Yeah, we joke about that. It's usually pretty fiery, but I think people are generally pretty respectful. Maybe had a few clashes over the years that maybe were not so much, including me with my infamous O.J. Argument against the O.J. documentary.
And now that's sort of kind of become the norm.
What?
Well, you get it in, put it in one theater, and it qualifies.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing, but
okay. But yeah. I believe this year Sam Rockwell is not a lead in anything. So there's that. Now we're doing inside baseball. Sorry about that, folks. So, yeah. Actually, speaking of which, because there are places like streaming places like Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, as Chris mentioned, the OJ documentary a couple years back, where. If you release it in theaters, even if it's New York, L.A., and Chicago, by the end of the calendar year, it qualifies for awards. And I know The Irishman was released on Netflix first, and now it is available in theaters. I implore you folks, if you get a chance to see it in a theater, do so. We as the IFJA got a screening of it in a theater at the beginning of December, and I'm really, really grateful for it.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of film that very much lends itself to you really got to see it in the theater. Not just because, you know, the big screen and the whole being enveloped in the experience kind of deal, but also the fact that when you go to a theater, you are more or less trapped. You have to stay there, and, you know, you just have to, by definition, have to become engrossed in that experience. Versus, I mean, let's face it, you know, when we're watching something streaming, I mean, you know, something that's almost 3 hours long, I mean, most people might watch that over the course of like 2 or 3 or 4 days. And that's just, it's just not the same experience
no.
to be consumed that
I
way.
Don't believe anybody on the internet did how to watch the last Avengers film like it was a miniseries.
No.
They just kind of did it, right?
Right.
So, yeah, and there was stuff that we will all see, because we get award screeners, first world problems, and there will be moments of, man, I wish I watched that on a big screen, because it would just be an even more fun experience.
Yeah, A Hidden Life by Terrence Malick, that's coming out next week or the week after.
I believe that's next week, because I would be discussing that most definitely, because he broke a rule of mine, and I'm not sure how to feel about it. I went through Terrence Malick's last probably 5 films. Have been just beautiful. They need to be 70 minutes.
Yeah.
And this time around we have, not to dive into it, you actually have a coherent storyline from Mr. Malick.
It's probably my favorite Malick in a while. As I say, Malick got a Malick. he has that style. It's very slow and poetic and cinematic, and his films are always gorgeous to look at.
But you know what's happening in this one.
Yeah, but I mean, he's just moving. I mean, his editing, you know, moves just, you know, in epics compared to compared to modern filmmaking and modern editing style. I mean, you know, even those just long panning shots and contemplations.
And yet he did Badlands and Days of Heaven.
Yeah, now Days of Heaven certainly has some of that quality. But yeah, Badlands remains my favorite of his, probably because it is most like a conventional film.
And I'm still the masochist that I would actually sit through the 5-hour Thin Red Line just to see, for curiosity's sake, how everybody got cut.
I'll still say, I think Hidden Life is, I think, 245, 250, something like that. I still think it would be a better film, like at a 2-hour mark. But it's still, it's very emotional, but we'll not blow it for next week's show.
But there is one thing that I'm working on next week's show. We're also in like every other work business, we're working ahead for the holidays, but, but no, opening in theaters this week, and I forgot that it did because we got a screener of it a while back and I watched it, but it's the drama, The Two Popes.
Yeah. And I saw this at a Heartland screening. My gosh, I think it was like September, October. It was a long, long time ago.
So you have basically a fictitious, everything's inspired or based or what could have been. It's I'll get to that. But it stars Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce as the characters, as the last two popes.
Benedict and Francis.
That's right.
One's still the current one.
Yes. And so what would happen if these two got together? It reminded me, this is the double feature with, and it's not Louis Malle's film, which we'll get to that in a second. But there was a film called, a really small picture called The Two of Us, with Aidan Quinn as Paul McCartney and Jared Harris as John Lennon. And there was a rumor that Lennon and McCartney met in a hotel room in 1976. This has that feel, only not nearly as good a soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah. My take on it was I called it My Dinner with Andre in Cassocks. there's a priestly garb for those of you who were not raised in the church. It's pretty much just those two characters. A couple of others intrude from time to time, but it's basically just servants who pop in. And it is the rarest of cinematic animals. It is a deep, serious and genuine exploration of faith by two men who, you know, that is the driving force in their life, is their faith in God. And they talk about, you know, the things that they really believe in. And, you know, Benedict is kind of very old-fashioned and doctrinaire about the Bible. And Francis is much more, you know, man of the people, has a sort of a natural charisma that Benedict is envious of. But they also talk about, you know, how they have failed as you know, shepherds to their flock, things that they did in their life that they regret. It's just splendidly acted, and, you know, if you think two priests talking for an hour can't be interesting, it definitely is.
This is from director Fernando Meirelles. Pardon my Brazilian, but the gentleman who gave us City of God and The Constant Gardener, and I'm with you about. The level of talk and the maturity and the respect that this brings to the film, and two good performances from non-Germans, non-South American actors. But you know, you have Anthony Hopkins, you have Jonathan Pryce. And you mentioned My Dinner with Andre. I did think of that while watching it. I wish it had been more like that. There's some fairly long flashbacks I didn't need at all.
Yeah.
If you have two acting thoroughbreds like Hopkins and Price, I think that's all you need.
Yeah.
And I wish they had snipped that down a little more. And this is not my I have the grindhouse rule. A lot of action films would just be better if they were 70 minutes long. And this isn't or my Terrence Malick rule. And this isn't quite like that. It doesn't need to be an hour and 10. But I think because we find out both of them have their own past before they became popes, as they were priests, as they were building themselves up. And I think just hearing it from those two actors with their expressive faces would have been enough. But I did like the two guys. I don't think – it sounds like you liked it way more than I did. But if you're – If you're looking for a spiritual film, or at least a healthy, respectable spiritual debate in cinema, this is right up there for you.
Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. It's not going to make my top 10 list, but it will be in that, you know, that list of, you know, 10 to 15 runners up, as it will.
The JV squad, yeah. I guess. So, okay, now also in theaters, if you want something bigger and louder, you got to see the latest Jumanji. This is now number 3, because there was Robin Williams' version.
Yeah, and these last two are not related to that.
At all. It's just a game name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think it's based on the board game in the old movie, and this one it's based on a video game, which is now old.
And you get a ride along. No, you get a Central Intelligence reunion.
Yeah.
With and Jack Black and a girl thrown in.
Yeah, I watched the first one. I thought it was really just, you know, bag of rocks dumb. just, you know, I mean, it's just Dwayne Johnson doing his just, you know, Nimrod stupid action movies. And this one, he was more kiddie aimed, you know, with stuff like that. I think it was even rated PG. I'm not sure. Didn't care for it. So I was not looking forward to this one. And I actually enjoyed it. It's
okay.
It's got a lot more things going on. You know, it's the same. The setup is it's teenagers who get zapped by the video game back into the world of Jumanji, where they take on these avatars played by other actors. Dwayne Johnson is like the big tough guy, and so on and so forth. Jack Black is like the nerdy maps guy. I'm trying to remember the name of the actress. Is it Karen Gilliam? She plays she's from the Avengers movies, the Marvel Comics universe as well. And she's in it. And of course, Kevin Hart as the chirpy little funny one, aka Kevin Hart in every movie he's ever
nice.
Made.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's light. It's definitely, you know, action packed, but, you know, and very much. I'm not sure what the rating is. I wouldn't be surprised if it's PG, so it's probably, or did they pop it up to PG-13? But it's not too bad. I would take my 9-year-old to see it. Probably maybe not my 6-year-old.
Will you have to?
No, I don't have to.
Oh, okay.
But the twist here is we've introduced two new characters, which is Danny Glover and Danny DeVito, and they get zapped into the game as well. And because they're doing, you know, they are taking over the avatars, like Dwayne Johnson spends half the movie talking like Danny DeVito, which sounds like it would not work, but it actually does pretty fun.
Okay.
And then Awkwafina, actress from The Farewell, comes in kind of midway as another character, and she has some fun also doing some change around. There's some flipping around of avatars. I don't have to say. It's still not, you know, this is funny movie making for the masses, and it, you know, it's the double cheeseburger of the cinematic fare, but I enjoyed it.
Did it, and it helped you cleanse your palate from award consideration stuff?
I'll tell you what, you know, because we've been binging these really serious, you know, Holocaust documentaries and just a lot of very, very downer material these last couple of months. So, yeah, so seeing a goofy video game-based movie with Dwayne Johnson and Jack Black and Kevin Hart, I had fun.
See, there, folks, sometimes it's all in the timing. That's just what happens there. So, yeah, I was one of those, I snarkily wrote, I just saw the Todd Haynes film Dark Water, the Mark Ruffalo lawyer underdog film versus Big Water.
Yeah, and it's an outrage genre.
I want to see your video store with those titles up there. So yeah, it's Civil Action is also in that section. Yeah.
Bad things being done to good people by other bad people.
Thank you, Anne Frank. But no, I wrote that there's a scene that happens at Christmas. Therefore, it's a Christmas movie.
Yeah,
because I've reached an age where I don't care what's a Christmas movie or not anymore.
I didn't see it. It was in my screener pile. Honestly, I kept moving it to the bottom because, like, you know, we, to all the critics in the IFJA, you know, we totally talk to each other, and we're not in a competitive way, but we're trying to say, like, hey, this one is really, really good. Make sure you check that one out.
Yes.
So we're, based on our recommendations from each other, we're constantly prioritizing and reprioritizing our list, and no one was saying anything. I mean, they're all respectful about Dark Waters, but no one was saying, like, you got to see this. So it just kept moving down, down, down the bottom of the pile.
Yep.
And it looks like it fell off the list for me.
There you go. And also opening this weekend, if you don't need any of those, apparently we needed another version of Black Christmas. The famous Canadian horror film from 1974, directed by the director of Children Who Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, Bob Clark.
And who also made A Christmas Story, and who also made Porky's.
Has there been a documentary made about Bob yet?
They really should. I mean, he had one of the most eclectic resumes in Hollywood history. Started making films, I think, right around 69, 70, you know. And then, you know, was pretty active up, I think, into the early 2000s. Tragically, he and his son were killed in a car accident.
Right.
I think in the early 2000s. And he was making, his last part of his life, he was making really sort of commercial.
He made Baby Geniuses.
Yeah, Baby Geniuses. Not terribly, you know, artistically ambitious stuff, but it was basically just sort of he got into, you know, dad mode or grandpa mode. He just wanted to make fun movies for his kids.
Well, there, and he did. Anyway, but that's not this. There was a version done in 2006. They had brought in Andrea Martin for that. But, yeah, there's a yet another version of Black Christmas.
I had forgotten there was another one in between. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I okay. Now, granted, it was not screened for us. But we can say you should watch the original 1974 version. Olivia Hussey, John Saxon, young Margot Kidder, young Andrea Martin. So
I've seen it, but it's so long ago that I don't remember it very well. The new one stars Imogene Poots is the biggest star in that.
Well, I hope she gets paid well.
I've only read a couple of reviews, and they were excoriatingly bad.
That's an NPR word right there. So, yeah, all that is happening in theaters right now. The big title on DVD and Blu-ray this week is Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I'll be talking about this weekend. If you complain about violence in his films, it only comes at the very, very tail end, and it's brief and fairly to the point by QT standards.
Yeah, and we actually had quite a discussion about that within our critics group. I didn't care for the violence at the end of it. I thought it was really over the top and unnecessary, which...
But most of the time with his stuff.
Yeah. I don't know. It just kind of comes out of nowhere, and it's very... I don't know. I had some problems with it.
Okay.
That way. We're not going to talk about Richard Jewell?
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I forgot about that. Yeah. The current news headlining,
I was gonna say,
controversial just, film, Richard Jewell.
Just like the mainstream media NPR, to try and ignore Richard Jewell.
No, I just forgot. I'm sorry. The latest film from 89-year-old director Clint Eastwood.
And isn't that incredible? He's still making about
a
movie
year.
A year.
Yeah.
I think he's made nine movies in the last 10 years, which there aren't too many directors of any age group that you could say is that prolific, let alone someone, you know, creeping up on 90. So that's pretty amazing. I don't think this last decade of movies for him has been nearly as good as the previous two. But
no.
I mean, if you do like the 2000 to 2010 or the 1990 to 2000, I mean, he was putting out great movies, not just
and
good movies,
different.
Great
I mean,
movies.
Different. So after Unforgiven, he has been able to get pretty much carte blanche, and make whatever the hell he feels like. And there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, and so this is kind of somewhat familiar territory for him. You remember, I think one of his last two movies was the one about the
1517, the Paris.
Yeah,
the one where he should have hired actors. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, where he took the actual soldiers who foiled a terrorist attack and cast them as themselves in a movie, and it's one of the things that just sounds like a great idea. And that was honestly probably one of his Eastwood's weakest films.
Yeah, and then he did The Mule last year. But apparently Richard Jewell does not get two three-ways in this film.
No.
But this is Clint's attempt to right a wrong, and it's, of course, Richard Jewell, the security guard who foiled the bombing at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. But there was also that little bit where he was deemed a suspect.
Oh, that went on for months.
Yeah.
This was really...
Pre-internet, folks.
This was one of a... Barely. I mean, it was 1996. Okay. There was some internet around, but, like, you know, wasn't until, like, maybe, like...
But by the time the show was over, you're still downloading stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it was really awful. It's really one of the worst acts of journalism malpractice in the modern era, where, okay, you know, the feds had nothing. So they leaked to the media that, hey, we're looking at the security guard who found it. And that's, I'm going to say that's fine. You know, they're not supposed to do that. But as we all know, you know, things don't work that way. But the problem was the media went from 0 to 60 on Jewell overnight.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone decided he was the guy. And, you know, I won't mince words. I mean, a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was a obese, slow-talking man with a southern accent who obviously had, like, self-esteem issues. And everyone looked at that guy and said, he can't be a hero. So when they had the feds just saying, hey, we're looking at him, it was just off to the races. And, I mean, that went on for
quite a while.
Quite a while. And it was really, really bad.
And it was one of those, once it was finally corrected, it got pushed back inside the paper, basically.
Yeah, they did not, you know, the media did not, we, you know, I was actively working as a newspaper reporter that back then, you know, we did not do a very good job of making things right. And the thing was, you know, the media, I mean, it was everywhere. It was, you know, CNN, everywhere, the newspapers, you know, no one was doing the legwork to connect him to the case. It was all just, well, the FBI says he is, and, you know, he had a, you know, couple of flirtations with the law back in the day. He actually had been a police officer at one point in his career. I think he was a deputy sheriff, and then he'd been working as either a college security guard or just basically security guard, you know, non-badged and gun LEO. And he actually, a lot of people don't know this, is he actually, you know, went back to working at a police force, and that's how he ended his career. He died young, unfortunately. It's a very good film. I'm misplacing the name of the actor. He's one of those guys.
Well, I have Paul Walter Hauser.
Paul Walter. I knew it was Paul and Walter was in there. But yeah, he's one of those guys you may recognize him, like, you know, playing kind of like side characters in other movies. He's really, really good, really embodies the heart and soul of Richard Jewell, who, I mean, he was not a complicated man. I mean, he pretty much was what you saw. He was a guy who, you know, had a simple sort of life. He respected authority. You know, he liked to do southern things like hunt and fish and stuff like that. One of my favorite parts of the movie. Sam Rockwell plays his attorney, and he's magnificent in it as well. Is that they've arranged a time for the FBI to come over and search the apartment where he shares with his mother. And so he's saying, like, okay, let's, you know, make sure everything's got our ducks in a row. And he says, do you have any guns in the house? And he just says to him, this is Georgia, sir. And proceeds to lay out an arsenal of, you know, hunting rifles and things like that. So I think it's a very good movie. It's probably going to make my top 10 list.
Wow.
It does have a very, not a fatal flaw, obviously, so if I'm putting it in my top 10 list, it does have a very significant flaw, which is, you know, you have, I believe it's Olivia Wilde.
Olivia Wilde, the director of Booksmart, folks.
Yeah, plays the reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who broke the story, Kathy Scruggs, and they use her real name in the story. She also died young, around the same time as Richard Jewell. So she's not around to defend herself. And it portrays her as having sort of, you know, a big personality and, you know, dominating the newsroom and, you know, maybe not being the nicest person to other folks, you know, which from what we've gathered, you know, she definitely had, you know, a big personality and things like that. The film implies pretty well, it doesn't depict, but it pretty well implies that she slept with an FBI agent played by John Hamm in order to get the scoop. There's zero evidence this happened. This is completely a Hollywood concoction, which, you know, as I say,
there's a reason why during the credits when the thing says this is based on.
Yeah. I mean, all movies lie. All movies lie. Even some documentaries don't tell the truth, but certainly all narrative films lie. You know, like the movie Ray with Jamie Foxx.
Oh yeah.
You know the big sequence about they finding out that he has an illegitimate child and oh the sperm and the drink. Okay, he had 9 illegitimate children. You know, so you can't do that scene 8 more times. You know, another movie that just came out recently, The Aeronauts, about a historic balloon flight in 1862. They wrote out one of the two guys who actually did the historic flight. Wrote him out of the story, invented a whole other character, and put her into the story instead.
So you could have a Theory of Everything reunion.
Yeah. So imagine if they were doing a movie about the adventures of Lewis and Clark, and they wrote out Clark and made up somebody else, and now it's, you know.
But she's pretty.
Yeah. So all movies lie. This movie lies in a way that is cheap, and vile and sexist, and it's just one of the oldest crutches that people say about female journalists, and it really is despicable. It's also bothersome because narratively you don't need it in the movie. I mean, you literally could have rewritten and reshot one scene in the film to show, like, this was a bad thing, without bringing in the sexist tropes to it. So, yes, it bothers me. Apparently it bothers a lot more folks in the media, even so, to the point where I don't think they're giving the film a fair shot or a fair evaluation. A lot of people saying, I'm not going to go see it because of this. Yes, it's a black mark on the movie, and I'm not going to diminish it. It really angers me that it's in there. It's still a very, very good film, and I recommend it. You know, I guess
see what it does to you. I guess as an audience.
Yeah, I guess in the end, the thinking is one bad turn deserves another. You know, the media was really, really bad to Richard Jewell, so here's the Richard Jewell movie being really, really bad to. The media in general is fine, but to one particular reporter in a way that's unfair and gross.
There you go. So, and you're also older than most younger people that
yes.
are going to be really ticked off and boycott a film.
Yeah.
It's kind of like boycotting the NFL. Like, were you watching the NFL before? Just saying. A little bit about Paul Walter Hauser. Because the first thing I noticed him in, because they go back to the 2010s, but I forgot, he was Sean in I, Tonya.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so this is the polar opposite of that character. Also appeared in Super Troopers 2, Black Klansman. Your film Late Night was in that. So this should be a big boost for him in that case. So there you go. You have four options in theaters. You have one big option on DVD and Blu-ray. But I do want to bring up, as we once coined, dead people we like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And we're going to wrap things up a little bit so we can sharpen our knives for the critics meet. This week was a tough week for that guys.
Yeah.
There are quite a bit. So we're going to start, and as I often do, I will go through IMDb and see what else they've done. And I forgot, I was mildly confused when I heard that actor Robert Walker Jr. passed away. And, of course, I went, oh, well, yeah, Strangers on a Train. Oh, no, that was his dad.
Oh.
So the son of Jennifer Jones and Robert Walker. And going back to the first thing I'm trying to remember that I noticed him in, because he did TV throughout the 60s and was mostly a TV actor from the 60s through, I believe, worked up until 2018. But a film like The Hook from 1963, The Ceremony, his first, probably of note, was he was the title character Ensign Pulver, because he was cheaper than Jack Lemmon in 1964, a not sequel to Mr. Roberts with that popular character. The Happening in 1967 was in The War Wagon. He had to deal with Kirk Douglas and John Wayne in one film. Killers 3 from 68 was in Easy Rider. Young Billy Young, Hex, Gone with the West from 74, Evil Town, and The Passover Plot. So, one of those, I think Passover Plot might have been the last thing I saw him in, but he kept working way up until his last credit from 2018. If you're a fan of science fiction television or Robert Altman films, that guy, René Auger-Benoit, passed away. Odo from, was it Deep Space Nine?
Yeah, I believe so.
And, yes, Benson, and he was the chef, the voice of the chef in The Little Mermaid, but right out of the gate worked with Robert Altman, who was Father Mulcahy in MASH. The thing I remember the most was he was the academic lecturer in Brewster McCloud, where as the film goes on, he is slowly turning into a bird. Not kidding, folks. Look at this. Played Sheehan in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and was also in Images, really underrated Robert Altman film. And then just became kind of that guy on television and movies. He was in the 70s version of King Kong, The Hindenburg, The Big Bus, Eyes of Laura Mars. Had one scene as a reporter, Harris from The Post, in the Bill Murray as Hunter Thompson film, Where the Buffalo Roam. Was the voice of the skull in The Last Unicorn. If you need warped 80s animated films, that's right up your alley. And Walker back in 1987. So, yeah, nice stuff there. Then we move on to Ron Liebman, who was married to Jessica Walter. So way to go, big shooter there. But Where's Papa from 1970, the Hot Rock. For you Indianapolis and Kurt Vonnegut fans, played Paul Lazzaro in the film version of Slaughterhouse-Five, directed by George Roy Hill. The Super Cops, romantic comedy. Norma Rae, which was probably his most one of his most noted supporting roles. Had his name taken off the Mad Magazine's Up the Academy when Mad Magazine tried to make their own version of Animal House, set in a military school for boys. It was also the villain in Zorro the Gay Blade, Rhinestone, 7 Hours to Judgment, Dummy, Night Falls on Manhattan, the Sidney Lumet underrated courtroom drama, and Garden State, as well as Autofocus. He played Bob Crane's manager, having to deal with Bob Crane in the 70s. And I'm a fan of Archer, and he was Ron Cadillac in Archer.
Hmm.
So, you all right over there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and then finally, as we're getting this today, Danny Aiello. Please, you had a description of Aiello before we went on. I would love for you to share that with the crowd.
Well, nobody got mad in the movies like Danny Aiello. I mean, when he got mad, and it seemed like, filmmakers quickly recognized that ability that to harness that passion, and so they always made a scene, at least one scene in every movie, where he got really, really mad. I mean, you're sitting in a theater probably 5,000 miles away from wherever Dan Aiello was in real life. You're sitting there watching the movie. You understand it's a movie, and he gets mad, and you're still scared because he's just it seemed like he just had that ability to just access that emotion with such immediacy, and it didn't feel like acting.
No. It was like Lewis Black. You think he's going to pop a blood vessel.
Yeah, I still remember seeing him. I mean, probably what was the Cher movie?
Moonstruck. Oh, yeah. A non-yelly screamy role. It's kind of like Pacino today.
Yeah, it's probably when most people became aware of him from the movies.
Yep.
But I remember, him in Do the Right Thing.
Oh, yeah. His supporting actor nomination.
Yeah, and there's a scene towards the end there where the Mookie character has destroyed the pizzeria, and they're there talking and confronting each other. He's talking about I built this with my own hands. And I'm just like
Now imagine that louder and more Italian.
Yeah, I mean I can't do that. I hate to say it. When the news came out just a few hours ago about his death, I was one of those people. I was like, sorry, I thought he was already dead.
You're a bad film critic.
9 years ago.
Nope.
Well, because I think he was in his 80s.
Yeah, he's 83, I believe.
And, nowadays it's almost like inconceivable that film actors retire.
By the way, Christopher Plummer turned 90 this week.
Yeah.
Knives Out star Christopher Plummer.
But, some actors just reach an age or a point in their careers where they just feel like they've done what they want to do. Him, Gene Hackman, really Joe Pesci. Had been that guy for the last few years until he got lured back into The Irishman. And, Danny just decided he was done, I guess. Although you say he was still working.
Still working. No, I go. This is one of those actors where he was still working up until he passed because he's got three credits in 2019 and something in post-production for next year.
All right, so I'm wrong. He was still working, but... Why wasn't he in movies or TV shows or things that people knew about?
I don't know. I think and from the actor's side, I would say, work is work. The last thing of note that I saw him in was Lucky Number 7 from 2006.
Yeah, see, that's about the last time I remember him.
But I'm looking at pre-production stuff, thanks IMDb, of a film called One Moment, of Hereafter Musical, a short film, The Black Caesar. Oh, please, don't let it be a remake of a Fred Williamson film. It's fine as is. And then The Italy Boys, that was in pre-production. So
maybe he's sort of doing on a lower level what John Travolta is doing, which is people aren't aware. John Travolta is still making movies.
Oh, yeah.
Every year, pretty much.
I believe his latest one, directed by the guy from Limp Bizkit, is out on video this week.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of straight-to-video kind of things. I'm sort of surprised he hasn't jumped on the Netflix or Amazon studio bandwagon.
But I remember when Seymour Cassell died, I'm like, he was still working up until, but it's one of those you would, I think we would walk, in the old days, we would walk past the video box and go, oh, there he is.
Yeah.
And this, so it's just kind of one of those.
Yeah. It's this weird way that the streaming platforms have sort of upended the traditional feature film model, and that we now have people coming out in shows or feature, even feature films that you're not even aware of. Or you're barely aware of them, you know, like
yeah.
Paul Rudd made a limited series on Netflix. Michael Bay has a new movie out.
Yeah.
Ryan
Reynolds.
With Ryan Reynolds. And you're like, Michael Bay makes a movie with Ryan Reynolds. You know, if that was in theaters and going through the traditional theater distribution, marketing, hype cycle, I mean, we'd know all about it.
And we would have not liked it.
And yeah, we probably still would not have liked it.
It would be on 3,000 screens. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just sort of astonishing how things are happening now and how, you know, it's still working that people like Ryan Reynolds, he's still making those big A-list movies, big budget, and we hear about them, but he's also doing these other things that we don't hear about. And maybe guys like Danny Aiello, you know, they're still out there working, and we just don't hear about what they're doing.
So keep looking, folks. Netta Ulaby from NPR did a nice tribute to him and made a point of saying that he brought a portion of New York that you didn't quite often see on screen. His first film role was Horace and Bang the Drum Slowly. He got to improvise.
Right.
He got to improvise a line as he was strangling. He said, I believe he said Michael Corleone says hello as he's strangling Michael Gazzo in The Godfather 2. He apparently improvised the line. Coppola liked it and kept it, so you can look that up. It was in the Front, a really underappreciated film with Woody Allen, not directed by Woody Allen, but by Martin Ritt, about the blacklist in New York in the 50s. Fingers, another underrated film, James Toback with Harvey Keitel. Blood Brothers, Defiance, High in Plain Sight. Was the police officer who threw a guy off a building in Fort Apache, the Bronx.
That's right. I forgot about that.
The character Police Chief Aiello, he is not Tony Danza, in yeah. Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, was in The Purple Rose of Cairo as Mia Farrow's husband, was a hitman in yeah. Radio Days, The Protector, with the last attempt to try to make Jackie Chan a U.S. action star, that failed miserably. Yes, he was the father in the Papa Don't Preach video for Madonna,
yep.
The Pickup Artist, you mentioned Moonstruck, January Man, which was a screaming festival between he, Rod Steiger, and Harvey Keitel. Yeah, got the nomination for Do the Right Thing. And then, yeah, there was a big streak through the 90s of Harlem's Nights and Jacob's Ladder and Once Around. And yes, no, I'm not going to play Swingin' on a Star from Hudson Hawk. I have a different tribute for the end of the show. Played Jack Ruby in Ruby.
Yeah.
Good for him. It was a leading role.
Yeah, leading role. Got to be first on the call sheet.
That's right. What Mistress, another underappreciated Barry Primus film, The Cemetery Club, The Pickle. He was in... Leon the Professional, Ready to Wear, City Hall, 2 Days in the Valley. So, yeah, nice stuff there. Always good, always likable guy. Always a good performance, even if the film, not so much.
Yeah, you know, he could do Rage, he could do Chilling.
And so anytime he could do something not like that, like Moonstruck or Cemetery Club, it was always a nice surprise.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is being, you know, a big guy with a face that looks like a camel that ran into a brick wall. He could just be imposing. If there's a word I could use to encapsulate his screen persona, it's imposing.
And you never ask for extra cheese. That's $2. So, and then finally, because it's where I work, Carol Spinney, the voice of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch, yeah. Age 85. I'm assuming you grew up on Sesame Street like I did.
I did. I love Sesame Street. It's sacrilege to say Mr. Rogers Show, not as much, although I did watch it. But yeah, I was a big, big Sesame Street guy. Ernie and Bert were my favorite.
Ah, okay. But, if you need to watch Follow That Bird from the 80s, you know, go for it. But yeah, this is one of those, there was that period of, he was there, his voice, in this case, his vocal work was with me every day.
Yeah.
Just like I was really hit hard when Charles Schulz died, because Charles Schulz was with me every day of my life. My mother died when I was 23, and, you know, he kept going, and then he died, and they still printed his stuff. I mean, think about something, folks, that you're with every day.
Yeah.
And Carol Spinney's work was a part of that for a long, long time.
There's a wonderful word that's been used to describe what makes a relationship, particularly with an audience, you know, with the media, with journalism and their audience, that's very much underrated. And the word is constancy, is that when you have that, someone is there every day. There's an engagement, even if it only lasts 15 seconds in a comic strip or 4 minutes on a TV show. It's just like, you know, they're going to be there. You know, they're going to show up. And I think that's going to continue with Big Bird.
I think so, too. I mean, and there will be, you know, other voices obviously will come and go. But yeah, I believe that's one of those.
Yep.
So, and I pat myself on the back for 20 years of radio service that way. Anyway, Chris, I appreciate you coming in and enjoy adult dinner. I should say grown-up dinner night. I don't want it to sound like an Eyes Wide Shut party.
Yes. And once again, congrats on the 20 years. It's a great achievement for anyone to do anything, particularly in the media. It's so hard in the media to last.
Even though I did not try to bury Richard Jewell, all right? Let's just get...
Yeah. But not to pump you up too much.
Thanks.
To say that when I came to the studio today and I walked in and told the lady at the front desk who I was here to see, she said, "Who?" And then she said, "How do you spell that?"
It's not our regular lady. No.
There's always something there to pump us up and always something to bring us back down.
I'm going to tell you how I deal with NPR fame as soon as we're done with this recording. So, all right, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz has spoken. And that's always for you. We're going to end today's show with music from Marie Fredriksson. She was a singer from Roxette. Roxette music was in 71 credits, according to IMDb.
What?
Yes. Most notably, the first time music by Roxette was used in a film, this song from Pretty Woman. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Next week, the big IFJA reveal, and hopefully a regular guest will be returning to Film Sociology, so you'll just have to tune in. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show, film podcast, here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life? Well,
let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!